Today on Doomed! Trump and Ukraine and Biden and the whistleblower and Rudy and Barr and Pompeo and my God, there are just so many names involved in this whole thing. And it's still going on too! But don't fret, on this episode of Doomed, join me, your host Matt Binder, as my guest, Matthew Gertz of Media Matters, breaks down the players, debunks the conspiracies, and walks us through the timeline of events that appear to be headed towards impeachment. Maybe, hopefully, for Donald Trump. But before we do that, a quick reminder. You can support this show via a small monthly subscription at patreon.com/Matt Binder. And that's it. That's the promo. Without any further ado, Matthew Gertz, he's a senior fellow at Media Matters. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Hey, Matt, how's it going?
Good, good. I'm just going to pull you up on the feed here so people can actually see who I'm talking. There we go. It's going great, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. It is, you know, I feel like whatever we talk about tonight will still be relevant, but who knows what will happen, hell, in just even a few hours, what news will break that'll throw the whole thing for another new swerve, right?
Yeah, you wake up every morning to new crimes. You go to bed every night to new crimes. It just sort of keeps on piling up.
Right. It's just the never ending story. Right. I mean, so you wrote this great piece for Media Matters that really, I think everyone who, you know, whether you follow politics or, you know, my audience does for the most part, I assume, but or someone, you know, if you're listening and you are completely out of the loop here, you wrote this fantastic piece. It's basically a timeline of events that led us here. And it really grabs everything, but also in the most digestible way I've seen. So let's start with this piece of yours that breaks it down. And to really get what's going on with Trump, Ukraine, Joe Biden, and all the other names that I mentioned, plus even more, we have to go all the way back to 2014, it seems like.
Yeah, we do. So there's a very, very complicated version of this, and there's a very, very simple version of this. And I think I'll start with the simple version first. We're going to get into all the weeds. I think it's important. But just to sort of give people a sense of like the broad contours of what's going on here. So we had this long conversation, this long debate over the last couple of years about collusion, whether the president colluded with Russia. And there was sort of a basic understanding from everybody that collusion was bad, that it was wrong for a politician who was running for office to reach out to a foreign government and ask them for help to win the election. Like, Republicans agreed with this, Democrats agreed with this. The distinction was whether or not you thought that Donald Trump had actually colluded with the Russian government or not. Republicans said that he hadn't, but it would have been bad if he had. Democrats generally said that he had and that that was bad. So that seems to be breaking down now, because the president is very, very publicly seeking aid from foreign governments, first Ukraine and this morning China as well, to help him with his re-election campaign. He is asking them to investigate Vice President Joe Biden, his son Hunter, and this is illegal. Like, it is against the law to solicit help from a foreign government to help you win a U.S. federal election. You're not allowed to do this. And again, we had broad consensus that this was bad, but now he's doing it publicly, and so Republicans, conservatives, Fox News hosts are all explaining, well, actually it's fine. And so that's the sort of the big picture around all this. The specifics here, I think, are also quite interesting about Ukraine. I think it exposes a bunch of conspiracy theories, a bunch of really bad faith bullshit arguments that are being made around this. But yes, it starts back in 2014. In 2014, Ukraine for a period of several years had been ruled by pro-Russia politicians who were extremely corrupt. That government lost in 2014. It looked like there was going to be, you know, a sort of less corrupt government moving in. Things were going to improve. Then Russia invaded, annexed part of the territory. And as at that point, the U.S. government started paying a lot more attention. Barack Obama basically made Joe Biden his point man for the situation in the Ukraine. He was going to take the lead role in responding to the crisis over there. Around the same time, Hunter Biden, as part of his business work, joined the board of a Ukrainian gas company called Burisma Holdings Limited. This was a firm that was controlled by a guy named Nikolai Zolashevsky, who had been a minister in the previous pro-Russian Ukrainian administration. So this caused some consternation in the White House. The vice president's office basically said, look, Hunter's a private citizen. He's going to do whatever he's going to do. We can't really interfere. It's not going to, you know, involve the government in any way. Fine. At some point, there was an investigation into Burisma because of you know, that Ukrainian oligarch who had been running it, allegations of corruption around that. The probe didn't really go very far. It was shelved sometime in 2014, 2015. And, you know, at that point, you know, that it's in itself became a concern for Western governments and, you know, people who were against corruption. It was part of a broader tendency of the Ukrainian government to be backsliding into this more corrupt state. A lot of this discussion ended up revolving around Viktor Shokin. Viktor Shokin was the general prosecutor. He was the person who was in charge of conducting these investigations. And he wasn't really doing his job. And so then Joe Biden showed up to try to deal with that. And that's where things get more complicated.
Now, before we go into the more complicated part of the story, I know it's been, you know, definitely with my audience here, a discussion around Hunter Biden taking this role and it being corrupt. And I think, you know, there is a real discussion to be had all around about the children of very powerful people getting hired in roles where, on its face, it looks like, you know, why are they being hired for these roles? You could see it with the Trump kids, what their current position in this government is. What is Ivanka and Jared Kushner doing where they are? And, you know, I think there's a conversation there to have around the son of a vice president taking a role on the board of a Ukrainian company, like we've seen here with Hunter Biden. But the thing is, what Trump is leveling here ruins any good faith discussion and conversation we can have about that, because what our concerns that were just mentioned about, I'm not sure if it's your concern, but I'm just saying, you know, our concern is in the broader public of people who would look at that as corruption. So I don't want to put words in your mouth. Those concerns are, you know, not the same as what Trump is saying here. What Trump is saying, and you could go ahead with this because this is where things get more complicated, but I want to get that out of the way now. If you are worried about the children or the cohorts of very powerful people finding themselves in positions where you believe they wouldn't be in if it wasn't for who their family was or who they knew, that's, to me, a decent discussion to have. It's a good discussion to have. But again, that's not what Trump is saying, and what Trump is saying ruins any good faith discussion we could have about that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's very difficult to, like, try to have the good faith discussion at a time when the president of the United States is, like, trying to force bullshit investigations out of foreign governments into the stuff. It makes it all very, very complicated.
Right. I mean, if you heard about Hunter Biden and this Ukraine stuff previously and it made you angry, you should be even more upset that Trump has ruined the conversation you would have probably liked to have about it.
This is actually something that came up where the New York Times reporter, who will come back to later, has done a lot of reporting on this, basically went on television and said, look, I'm trying to get to the bottom of this Ukraine story, and I'd do a better job of it if Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump would like stop doing what they're doing.
Right.
It's kind of messing up my whole thing here.
It's going to be seen as partisan by somebody at this point.
Well, I mean, this is the sort of issue that's created when you have a president who's like basically, you know, has an authoritarian mindset, is not terribly interested in basic norms of rule of law or anything like that, and is just sort of using the power of the government to benefit his personal interests. Like that eventually becomes kind of a problem, it turns out.
Right.
But so the specifics of what the president has been alleging. So basically, Joe Biden went to Ukraine in December of 2015 as part of this effort to be the point man around all things Ukraine. And while he was there, he basically went to the Ukrainian government and said, so this guy, Viktor Shokin, who's your prosecutor, is doing a terrible job. He's not doing any corruption investigations. We're giving you guys a ton of aid. We're giving you guys a ton of help. And in response, you're like not cleaning up your act. We need you to get rid of this guy and replace him with someone who will actually do his job, or we're gonna cut off the aid. Now, this was, you know, so the way that the Trump administration, the way that the president is spinning this is that Joe Biden went there and he got the prosecutor fired because the prosecutor was investigating Joe Biden's son, that it was like an entirely corrupt action on his part,
right,
trying to help a member of his family. That appears to be complete and total horseshit. So we've established the investigation wasn't going on at the time, and this was part of the reason like the West was kind of concerned about it. The U.S. government was not alone thinking that the Ukrainian prosecutor was falling down on the job. Lots of other Western governments were concerned. Ukrainian anti-corruption people were concerned. Republican senators had actually sent a letter to the Ukrainian government saying, like, you've got to get rid of this prosecutor. He's not doing his job. So Biden was acting on behalf of U.S. interests in agreement with basically everyone else who's monitoring the situation in calling for Shokin to be pushed out. Shokin was pushed out. All the anti-corruption people cheered. This was seen as a positive sign for Ukraine, that things were, you know, going to improve. And that's, you know, where for a while the Ukraine side of stuff kind of dies down.
And now that, we
and that takes us through like 2018 or so.
Right. And it's amazing how there seems to be this lull that pretty much comes, I don't know, I guess really after, you know, I mean, some things happened after Trump was elected president, but it seems like there's a pretty long lull here after Trump wins the election to now when the next election starts to come. I mean, we're right now, we're in primary season pretty much, earlier than ever before. It started like at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the obvious reason that there like wasn't a lot of uproar at the time and there was this long delay is because Biden was doing a thing that like basically everyone thought at the time was normal and good, and it's only, you know, once we got into the sort of framework of Joe Biden might be running for president that it turned into a hot political story, so to speak. And yeah, so this involves an old friend from the 2016 campaign, a guy named Peter Schweitzer. Peter Schweitzer is an editor at large at Breitbart. He is president of this organization called the Government Accountability Institute, which is a sort of right-wing foundation. Both GAI and Breitbart were heavily funded by the Mercer family, which is this billionaire pro-Trump family. Steve Bannon ran both of those organizations as well at various points. So he's, you know, sort of a conservative activist of long standing, someone who his sort of mission is to point out corruption by politicians, normally Democratic ones, sometimes Republicans who are sort of on the establishment side.
Right.
And, you know, he in 2015 had a ton of impact with his book Clinton Cash, which dealt with aspects of the Clinton Foundation. Clinton Cash was, I think, much more successful because he was able to get mainstream newspapers to partner with him. He would basically send out chapters of the book before publication to the New York Times, Politico, a couple of others, and basically say, like, you can report this out and just do a story on it and, you know, say that it came in part out of my research. And they did it. Like, they took it as leads. They treated it credibly. Sometimes they pointed out falsehoods. Sometimes they didn't. There were a lot of falsehoods to point out. But the theory behind this is all publicity is good publicity. If you can get your massive oppo document of Republican talking points into the New York Times, into Politico, it doesn't really matter if they're pushing back on some aspects of it. You're still creating this swirl of corruption around the Democratic politicians that you're trying to target. So in 2015, that was Hillary Clinton. The 2018 book that he wrote has a few chapters on Biden, some chapters on some other politicians as well. And the Biden section includes there's an entire chapter called Biden's in Ukraine, which deals with various aspects of Hunter Biden's business interests there. Also, some aspects dealt with about China, which maybe we'll come to later. There's so much of this garbage. Yeah.
See, this is where we get, to me, this is where it gets even a little bit more interesting. And this is to me the red meat, one of the many red meat parts for this specific show, which really usually gets into the weeds of various right-wing conspiracies and dark web internet happenings and all that fun stuff. So to me, let's actually get deeper into this whole strategy here, because you wrote a separate piece on this, and I think this is where we could take maybe, and it's not really a detour from, it's maybe a detour from the broader timeline, but it's not a detour from the story. Let's get a little bit deeper into this strategy that they're looking at here, because the Clinton Cash strategy was basically just basically laid out a major part of it with how they how he dripped it out and partnered with news sites, with legitimate American news media outlets to do so. So let's dive a little bit into this Clinton Cash repeat here. I guess Clinton Cash part deux.
So, as I said, the strategy for Clinton Cash was to partner directly with news outlets. For whatever reason, that wasn't really viable for the second book.
Think it's because his game is sort of up when it comes to at least the media? Like, they caught on to him after they already did the work to knock Hillary?
I think there's a couple of different parts, but I think one part is that, yes, I think there's a general understanding that trying to partner with him in the same way would have rendered a lot of outlets pretty toxic, or at least subject to withering criticism for repeating the exact same shit that they had done in 2016. You know, another part of it is the book comes out in the spring of 2018. It's not really clear at that point that Joe Biden is going to run for president. You know, it was sort of rumored that he might, but it was really very much an open question at that time. So, you know, as compared to spring of 2015 when the Clinton book came out, and I think she already had declared she was already running. So it was just happened in a different phase of the campaign. And so there was just less interest in trying to cover that. It was also more of a hodgepodge book. There's some stuff there about Biden's family, but there's also some stuff about John Kerry's family and various other politicians' families and their business interests. It was just sort of a broader topic that I think made it less attractive to news outlets at the time. But for whatever reason, it didn't work. And so they I don't know if they deliberately did this, but they a second strategy has evolved for getting these tidbits out there. And it basically seems to amount to having Rudy Giuliani like basically read passages from the book for all intents and purposes to regular reporters. I'll sort of explain this. So in May, there was a report in the New York Times by Ken Vogel, who's an investigative reporter there. It dealt with these Biden-Ukraine accusations to some extent, but buried in there was, I think, the actual news, which was that Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, had been engaging directly with Ukrainian officials to try to push this story and get them to investigate Joe Biden and his family, which, again, like, this is the collusion stuff that for several years we had all agreed was bad. But suddenly was just sort of happening out in public. And so Rudy Giuliani for the previous 6 months had been connecting with various Ukrainian officials and former officials, including Shokin himself. Shokin had apparently told him that he had really been on the verge of breaking the whole Hunter Biden story wide open when he was fired. Giuliani, either because he's an idiot or because, you know, it's useful for him, decided to accept that and just start telling people that that's what was going on. And so this this Vogel piece kind of brought that conspiracy theory that Joe Biden had gotten this prosecutor fired for in order to help his son into the mainstream discussion. So when you have a story like this, what ends up happening is a lot of debunking happens, a lot of pointing out the various aspects that are false happens, but there's still a conversation about Joe Biden and corruption that you weren't previously having.
Right.
And so, you know, for Rudy Giuliani, that is a good deal. It gives him, you know, an opportunity to go on a lot of television shows, have reporters ask him, what are you talking about? What, this corruption has all been debunked. And for him to sort of sprinkle out new details that he's gotten from the Schweitzer book or these interviews he's been doing in with Ukrainians or what have you, it becomes a vector for him to deepen the conspiracy theory, to push it out into the mainstream, and to create enough smoke that it raises the question for people whether there is fire there, whether there is actual corruption. It creates the discussion that hadn't been there previously. And so, you know, he's doing this a lot with Ukraine. He's also, you know, as this story took on more attention because of the whistleblower coming forward, the Trump phone call, he started talking more about China and Hunter Biden's work there, right, which, you know, is sort of tangentially related, also appears in the Peter Schweitzer book. That seems to be the new strategy for secret empires. Whereas before, with Clinton cash, they could just farm it out directly to reporters. Now, Giuliani is serving as sort of the go-between, the person taking those stories and bringing them to mainstream outlets and to conservative outlets as well. So all of these stories, both Ukraine and China, have received a ton of attention from Fox News, especially since Giuliani sort of came forward in that New York Times story. They've become, you know, part of the drumbeat that Sean Hannity uses, you know, several times a week, talking about Biden and corruption and all of that sort of thing.
This is not exactly how it is, but it's sort of funny to me where it's like, you know, the media, like you said, they did the Clinton cash, they took the Clinton cash stories, but now they're like, nah, Schweizer, we're too smart for that. And then they're just like, a couple of years later, they're like, I mean, not even a couple of years later, they're too smart for this time around, but then they go ahead and go, but okay, Giuliani, come on TV and why don't you just regurgitate what Schweizer wants us to print anyway?
Yeah, and so it turns into often, you know, confrontational interviews, which I guess is the best they can do. But at the end of the day, you're having the discussion that he wants to have on his terms.
Right.
and the, you know, letting the misinformation get out there.
So I just want to, sort of clarify somewhere where I'm a little bit confused with. Now, what part, what was the thing that really pushed, and we're going to get into this right now, I guess, where the whistleblower comes out. Mm-hmm. What part of, at what point does Trump decide that this is what he wants to go into? Like, this is where he wants to take this. He wants to discuss this with Ukraine. He wants to discuss Joe Biden and his son with Ukraine. Is what sort of informed him about this the Schweizer book, or was it the New York Times piece? Where does Trump decide this is the play he wants to make?
It's not entirely clear. Giuliani starts getting involved and interested in the Ukraine story in fall of 2018. That's when he talks to Shokin. That's when he sort of gets involved in the dealings there. There are several other threads of the conspiracy theory that all sort of wind together around this. So where do I start on this one?
Right. There's, okay. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking the CrowdStrike thing, which we'll get to.
The CrowdStrike.
Yeah. This is.
So conservatives have been talking about Ukraine really since like 2016. It really gets intense, though, in 2017 as part of the effort to push back against the Mueller probe, the idea that Trump had colluded with Russia. There are a couple of ways that manifests. One is CrowdStrike, which is basically an attempt to say, okay, Russia didn't actually hack the DNC. The DNC faked that whole thing. And then the emails that were stolen from the DNC got out somewhere. This part's not really clear. Right. But
and just so for people who don't know what CrowdStrike is, I'm sorry, I just want to make sure they get it. Sure. CrowdStrike is a security firm that basically the DNC hired, their third-party company. They're not connected to the DNC other than the DNC hiring them to basically deal with what happened in 2016 where the DNC servers were hacked.
Right. The DNC servers were hacked. You know, the U.S. government, through the Mueller probe and various intelligence reports, has said that Russia did it. They did it to benefit Donald Trump's election campaign. There's some question about the extent to which the Trump people knew that this was happening. But like that part of it is very well established, that Russia hacked the DNC. But conservatives would prefer it if that wasn't the case, because it creates all of these uncomfortable questions, like why was Russia trying to elect Donald Trump president of the United States?
Right.
So one thread of the conspiracy theory is that Ukraine it somehow controls CrowdStrike, and on Ukraine's behalf, CrowdStrike lied about the whole thing, and Russia never hacked the DNC. Okay, that's one part of the conspiracy theory. There's another part that suggests that the actual real collusion happened between Democrats and the Ukrainian government, and that it was a sort of vast conspiracy between the Clinton campaign and the Ukrainians to target Paul Manafort. You may recall was briefly Donald Trump's campaign chair, fired because it turns out that he, you know, was breaking the law a lot
right.
through his various business dealings, which involved Ukraine. Remember that Russian-backed government that was overthrown at the beginning of the timeline
right.
Back in 2014? He was responsible for like helping to run the campaign for the Russian-backed government.
Right.
So he is now in jail, in prison, because he did many crimes.
The funny thing about this is Manafort's not even in prison for anything that he did to help Trump. Like,
no, he's in prison for things that he did to like to help the Russian-backed Ukrainian oligarchic government. Yeah.
Right. So like the smart play from the Trump world, in my opinion, would be like just literally ignore that whole part of it, because you could just say, oh, see, they looked into him. He's in jail for other things. But nothing to do with us. I mean, why? Like, what the thinking there?
there's a pathological desire on the part of the president and like a lot of people around him to basically say anything that he is accused of doing, actually the other guys were doing it.
Right.
You know, they're the real racists, they're the et cetera, et cetera. They're the ones who don't care about rule of law, so on and so forth. And so that's sort of what's going on there. So he's been aware of that threat of the Ukrainian stuff for quite a while. It gets heavy play on Fox News. But by that part, I mean the Democrats did the real collusion. That's been part of Sean Hannity's shtick for the last several years. Hannity, of course, is a personal friend of the president, someone who the president apparently talks to nearly every night after his show. So anytime now, really, he'll be making a phone call. And so, yeah, the president has tweeted about that. He's talked about it publicly. The Joe Biden Ukraine stuff, the president first mentioned in May after the Giuliani stories broke. He went on Fox News and did an interview where he said, like, you've got to look at Joe Biden. He called up the Ukraine government and said, don't prosecute my son. And if you don't fire this prosecutor for doing this, you know, we're going to pull the funds. So it's a total lie, total conspiracy theory. He said it on Fox News. That's when it became aware that he was publicly interested in that aspect of the story.
Now, where does John Solomon? We're going to get to the whistleblower thing in a minute. I know that's like the where this is all going to, and where obviously the most relevant. But I think this might be the last piece that brings us there. Where does John Solomon of the Hill fit into all this?
So John Solomon is he's an opinion columnist at The Hill. He is someone who has been sort of plugged into the smear machine that the Republicans have wound up in response to the Mueller investigation over the last several years. Always has very hot scoops that get him on Sean Hannity and then fall apart completely when like anyone else looks at them. So his part of this was he was the one who first reported that the top Ukrainian prosecutor who Biden got fired had been fired specifically because of the Hunter Biden investigation. So where he got that story, it's unclear. He cited Ukrainian sources. You know, the timeline is such that you know this was all happening after Giuliani had started looking into all of this, and so you know, it seems likely that he plays a role as sort of the intermediary there too, but not entirely clear. And so he, by virtue of being someone who's in Sean Hannity's inner circle, again, you know, he's been doing, you know, he's on Hannity several times a week at this point to talk about whatever scandal stuff Hannity is interested in. And so he really sort of supercharges this onto Fox News.
Now, at this point, when Giuliani's doing all these things, is he doing this basically already at the behest of Trump? Like Trump has already told him to go do this, correct?
I mean, the way he put it was, I am acting on behalf of my client for the benefit of my client and also sort of my country. But you know, he made it very clear that like he is doing this in his capacity as the president's personal lawyer.
So it's possible that Giuliani's actually the one who spearheaded this and gave Trump this whole idea.
Yeah, I think he's certainly playing a big role there. You know, the trick, it's very, very tricky sometimes to figure out like where exactly the information flow is getting to the president. So obviously a lot of this stuff is happening around Fox News, which he you know, watches several hours of every day. And so he's really just sort of soaking that in and then spewing it out. But Giuliani as an intermediary, I think, also makes a lot of sense. Giuliani also watches a lot of Fox News at this point, so you know, he could be getting it there. And he could also be sort of the direct intermediary for a lot of this information as well. So it's a stew. It's a real...
A yummy MAGA stew.
Yes.
So let's get to now the call, which then leads us, of course, to the whistleblower. But the call. Let's break this down.
Right. So in July 25th, the president has a call with the newly elected president of Ukraine, whose name is Volodymyr Zelensky. And Zelensky, you know, they're basically having, at this point, Ukraine is like almost a client state of the United States. They're really reliant on us for security, for money, for weapons, you know, because they're basically in a long-running, sort of sometimes cold, sometimes hot war on their border with Russia.
Right.
So as part of this, they're you know, having this conversation on the phone, and Zelensky says that he's interested in buying some Javelin missiles from the United States, and Trump literally says, "Okay, but I want a favor from you," and the favor that he wants is for Zelensky and his people to work with Rudy Giuliani on the CrowdStrike situation, and to work with Rudy Giuliani on the Joe Biden corruption situation. He's asking for investigations from the Ukrainian government for the direct partisan interest of himself. So this is, not, again, because as we mentioned at the top of the show, collusion is bad and you're not supposed to do it. This is a problem because he is asking a foreign government for help with his election and holding, you know, the prospect of a benefit in weapons, in closer ties with the United States over that government's head as leverage. This is like really extremely clear what's happening. There's been a sort of partial transcript that's released, which is how I know exactly what was said, at least for part of the call. It's all very, very clear. Like there's not a lot of gray area here. There's gray area in the sense that the president, like a good mobster, knows that you shouldn't say, if you do X, I will do Y. And so instead hears, I would like X, and says, ah, I would like Y, and just sort of leaves it to everyone to fill in the gaps there, which are not hard to fill in at all, because this is all really, really crystal clear. But yeah, he comes out and does it, right? Like he's basically saying, will you collude with me on my election in this phone call? So at this point, the phone call's transcript is put into the secret vault that only is supposed to hold like top secret communications, even though there's not really any top secret stuff discussed on the phone call.
Right. Well, top secret if you're Trump and don't want anyone to know about what was discussed in the phone call.
Right. There's no information that like legally falls under the, like they didn't declare any of the information in this phone call top secret. Like when the phone call was released, there was nothing top secret that had to be redacted or anything like that. But yeah, it was politically inconvenient. Right. And so it went in this vault. At this point, a whistleblower gets involved. There is some person who we later discover is a CIA officer who had been tasked to the White House, who basically, you know, hears from a lot of people about this phone call, decides that sounds really bad because, again, it's really bad.
Right. You know, it is funny. Like, I mean, you've been saying it 100 times, and I'm glad you have, because you really have to drive home the point, I think, here. I'm going to even do it myself right now. A president who spent the last year, probably even more, tweeting pretty much every morning, no collusion, is now coming out saying, but if I did collude, which I did, no big deal. So who cares if it was no collusion, if it was okay to begin with? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Total exoneration. But if I had done those things, it would be very legal and very cool.
Right. Why?
That's where we are at this point.
I know, you know, to even compare this to the Mueller report, like I throughout the whole couple of years, what was it, year and a half where the Mueller report was being, where Mueller was investigating, you know, there were parts where I was like, this is really bad for the president and it's damning. And there's parts where I'm like, all right, people are going out of their minds with this. I'm skeptical on this part of it. You know, and I think when the Mueller report came out, I think a lot of my feelings on it were validated in terms of Trump did bad things. A lot of things that weren't those bad things in there were overblown. And in the end of the day, unfortunately, I don't think that report, you know, while definitely looked bad, in my opinion, was enough to launch this an impeachment inquiry on that alone. I think at the end of the day, there was an argument to be made that, you know, there's not, you know, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But I think this is, I mean, we're now, I don't even know how clearer you can, what I can say that's even clearer than the term crystal clear.
I mean, like, I think the issue here is, by the standards that Republican senators were going by in 2017, in which it would have been really bad if Trump had colluded, which is why it's a good thing that he didn't. What the president is doing now is really bad because he's just going out and admitting that he's like today, White House lawn into cameras saying, yeah, Zelensky, if I were Zelensky, I'd do an investigation into Joe Biden, you know, China too. He's saying like, look, China should do an investigation. He's, you know, we're in the middle of this trade war that he's wrangled up with China.
Right.
And now he's basically signaling to the Chinese government that like the thing that he really wants is an investigation into the Bidens that will be useful for his political campaign. Like, they're not idiots.
Right.
They're going to look at that and say, oh, well, we don't really care about this investigation. It's nothing to us. We don't really have functional rule of law here in China. We just sort of do whatever. So, sure, why not? If we can get a tangible, material, like, thing in return, and, you know, we can probably arrange this in a way where we don't need to, like, say, I'm doing X and you're doing Y, just to, you know, because the Americans might get pissed or whatever. This is not a difficult case for them, I don't think.
I mean, we've already seen them, allegedly, I guess I should add, do favors for the Trumps in the form of the many different trademarks they've suddenly given Ivanka Trump's companies.
Yeah, well, we've suddenly, you know, that kind of, it is interesting how interested Donald Trump is in the supposed conflicts of interest created by family members who have business dealings overseas all of a sudden, when it doesn't involve the ones that he literally put on the payroll of the White House, right?
Like, to me, that's the part that, like, again, like, if you're someone who's bothered by the children of powerful people getting cushy jobs, making tons of money when they really probably don't belong where they are, I mean, you got to bring up the Trumps along with Biden. And
yeah, I think we ask our politicians to, like, do a lot of things to try to ensure that there aren't conflicts of interest, that there isn't corruption. You know, we ask them to divest from their holdings, to, like, not be running businesses on the side while they're, you know, president or vice president. And Biden, you know, got out of any other, you know, business entanglements when he became vice president. Donald Trump did not do that, right? He's got the sort of not really a firewall, and his companies are being run by his sons. You know, we ask politicians to not hire their kids. Joe Biden didn't hire his kids. Donald Trump did. We ask them to, like, divulge a lot of information about their financial dealings, about their, you know, their tax returns. And Joe Biden did that, and Donald Trump hasn't. Like, there's a lot of things that we want politicians to do to create more transparency around this stuff. And, like, Donald Trump just doesn't do any of that, and has basically discovered that if you just decide not to do it and you just bullshit anyone who asks for anything, and you can just keep saying, yeah, all of my tax returns forever are being reviewed by the IRS indefinitely.
Right.
And, like, what's the next, like, of course it's a lie, but, like, what do you do after that? Right.
Right. So let's get to the whistle. Well, you already mentioned the whistleblower, but let's get to the a little bit more into that. So, when presidents make these calls, often, unless they're specifically told to not listen in, often staff, aides, members of the cabinet will be listening to the calls to see, you know, just to check in what's going on. That's an accurate description of how it usually goes, right?
Yep, that's right.
So, and this would include intelligence agents.
Often, yes.
Right. So, these whistleblowers, do we know, there's more, I mean, there's one whistleblower, but the whistleblower, him or herself, did not listen to the call themselves. Basically, they had numerous different individuals come to them with information about what they heard on this call. That's correct, right?
Right. So the whistleblower files a complaint based on this information. It's secondhand but considered credible. He submits the complaint to
the inspector. We know the whistleblower is a guy?
We know it's a guy, yeah.
Okay.
It's been reported as a male CIA agent.
Got it.
The Times first, and then I think the Wall Street Journal mirrored that, and I think the Post did too.
Oh, right, and that's when people got pretty upset that the Times would even give any information away, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that caused a bit of a stir too. So this started breaking middle of September. We learned that a complaint had been made to the Inspector General of the intelligence community, which is the sort of ombudsman of sorts, someone who takes these complaints, investigates them, determines if they were credible. The Inspector General determined that this one was. He did an investigation which involved finding a bunch of the primary sources that had been talking to the whistleblower, confirming that all of this had happened, and finding that this was a big enough deal that it needed to be sent to the congressional committees where that this would normally go. That then got stopped. The complaint was not allowed to go through. At that point, Congress found out about the existence of this complaint and started making a big stir. And that led to the sort of a careening series of news cycles that we've had lately, where the complaint was released, the transcript of this call was released. This after several cycles of, you know, various aspects of the call leaking out, and that in turn triggers the announcement of the impeachment inquiry.
So, what we get? Let's get to the part where basically there was this meeting, basically, that at the UN, I believe it was, right, where Trump is sitting there with the Ukrainian president, Zelensky. And he's basically, I mean, the president of Ukraine looks incredibly uncomfortable during this whole exchange. Do we know exactly what the Ukraine officials have said? They allowed this transcript to be released when the White House released what was said on the call. And I should amend there. It's not a transcript what they released. It is basically a summary is a good a memo, I believe, is what they called it. But it's a lot of things are taken out. It's not exactly word for word, but it is sort of amazing that what they did release is what they deem to be not damning for the president, when even that is damning for the president.
Yeah, the Ukrainian president apparently was kind of miffed about this because he thought that only the president's part of the conversation was going to be released and not his part of the conversation, which means that includes stuff like him trying to suck up to the president by saying how much he enjoys his stay in a Trump hotel, which is not ideal. I mean, again, like, this is what makes the whole thing, both the phone call and the personal meeting with the president extremely uncomfortable. Like, Ukraine needs a lot of stuff from the United States, which means they need a lot of stuff from President Trump. And President Trump has things that he wants from Ukraine and is not very subtle about it. And the things that he wants are not like normal things that a normal president would ask for. That creates a certain amount of chaos, I would say.
So how is this playing out in Ukraine? Do we, like, Is Zelensky a guy who where's his ideology lie? I know this guy's a former comedian. He seems
right.
You know, he was brought. It seems like he got voted in on someone on being an outsider, sort of an anti-establishment figure. Which, you know, it could mean you're a demagogue who just pretends to be one, like Trump, or it could mean that you are a legitimate, you know, left-wing populist. It really depends.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like he is. He has a lot of focus on anti-corruption. That's sort of been his thing. And I think Trump sort of taking advantage of that by saying, like, oh, well, the real corruption is Joe Biden, and that's what you need to get in on.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's now get to, because this is where I think, you know, we have Pelosi finally coming out with the impeachment, announcing the impeachment inquiry. And this is something where a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberals, progressives have been pushing for this impeachment inquiry way before this Ukraine information came out. But I think, like I said, this Ukraine corruption, collusion saga is so much more damning than the Mueller report, that it's impossible that they wouldn't look into this. But, you know, a little bit off topic here, it's sort of disappointing to me that they're maybe this will change as this continues to unravel. But the fact they would just focus on this, because I think there's even more corruption in terms of the enrichment of Donald Trump's various businesses, as well as his personal wealth, obviously, through his businesses, that I think this should lead into also investigating. But that's another story for another day. Where I think this unraveled even more to me, and this just happened over the past few days, is basically the talking points of the White House coming into full display. They basically released these talking points on how Republicans in the Senate and the House, and of course their favorite pundits over at Fox News and other right-wing outlets, should defend their wonderful Emperor Trump. And basically, The one they're going with now is that Adam Schiff, their number one enemy, it seems, on at least in the House, worked to basically help write the whistleblower complaint.
Right. So this is something that they started saying pretty early in the story. They were saying, well, this complaint is too well written. Like, it's too good. And so therefore, it must have been sort of planted in some way. It must have involved Adam Schiff, the Democratic chair of the Intelligence Committee, in some way. I think it has since come out that his office was aware of the whistleblower and had basically, after being contacted by the whistleblower, said, like told him, like, the way to do this is to go through the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community. Again, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, that's what congressional committees do. They take complaints from whistleblowers and figure out, like, how, you know, what the best way to process them is. Again, like, everything that, like, the stuff that's in the complaint is all corroborated by the transcript, that, or not transcript, but whatever, that the White House released. Like, there's not, like, he did the thing.
Right.
And then he went out again in public and is on camera doing the same thing. Like, there's not, again, this is both a very complicated story with a lot of conspiracy theories and angles and sprawl, and a very, very simple story in which the president is abusing his power and seeking aid from a foreign government to benefit his election, which is illegal. You're not, whether you receive aid or not, you are not allowed to solicit aid from a foreign government. And he knows this because when he suggested that he would accept aid from a foreign government a few months ago, again, on camera in an interview, the head of the FEC put out a statement saying, this is illegal, you're not allowed to do this.
Right.
None of this is rocket science.
Right. To me, the interesting thing too about the, and I said this online because it just bothered me so much when I saw it. You know, here we have a whistle. You know, we've had a decade basically under the Obama administration and now under the Trump administration where there seems to have been a, you know, it's real, it's bothersome to see it happen in both administrations, a war on whistleblowers. And, you know, we've seen, you know, here in this position now, we have a whistleblower who, by all intents and purposes, followed the procedures by the book, did everything they were supposed to do to bring about their worry about what they were told was on this call to the proper through the proper channels to be investigated. And we have the Trump administration and the Republicans in Congress and right-wing pundits basically attacking this whistleblower for going through the proper channels and doing the procedures as they were supposed to do. And I mean, after 10 years of, you know, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Reality Winter, what we vindicated them here. I mean, there's no way to me, like, you could say, go through the legal the proper channels now, because guess what? You're going to be demonized by someone regardless. In fact, you going through those legal procedures are going to be used against you as you colluding with the people who you went to who are part of the procedures. It's insane to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the conundrum that you're stuck with at this point, right? Like, there's nothing you can do. Especially in the Trump administration, the idea that you could think that there was some wrongdoing happening is in itself evidence that you are a deep state agent who's just out to get the president. Otherwise, why don't you just support whatever he wants to do, right? Like, that's basically where we are.
Right. Now, there's another name that has somehow got swept up in this. There's all these names we got. I mean, today we have, a State Department member, Kurt Volker. He was speaking with the House Intelligence Committee for like 9 hours or something like that.
Yeah, he was the U.S. envoy to Ukraine after we fired the ambassador for basically not supporting Rudy Giuliani enough in his effort to get Ukraine to investigate.
Perfect, just perfect. So along with that name in the media, we have this name that, you know, Chad Kroeger. Of course, I'm talking about the singer of Nickelback. And I want to end it here because this is really, if there's anything that can, like you've been saying over and over again, and I think if you were to summarize it to someone in 10 seconds, you've laid out the perfect way to do it. You have a president who is saying over and over again that something is not wrong. That's saying that he didn't do something that's wrong. And now he's saying that wrong thing he claimed all along to not be doing. He did it, but it's not wrong. I mean, to really make it even more insane, we end it with a copyright takedown because the president tweeted out a video where I still don't know who made it. It almost feels like, God, if it was made by the Trump campaign themselves, that'd be even more crazy. But there's this video where, you know, he uses the clip of Biden talking about the prosecutor from Ukraine, he being fired. And then there's cuts to a music video from Nickelback. Look at this photograph. And it's edited so the photograph Chad Kroeger is holding is this picture of Joe Biden with his son Hunter Biden with this executive who worked for that Ukrainian company that Hunter Biden worked with, playing golf or something like that. It's an insane video. A copyright takedown was requested and Twitter took it down. And I have to say, actually, the one area of this whole saga where I will defend Trump, I believe that video would fall under fair use. I think he has a case to make as to that video not being taken down. Enough was done to it where I believe it's transformative.
Yeah.
Right. So there you go, Trump. I'll stand up for you. Well, I'm not going to die on that hill, but I will defend you on that one.
I mean, there are also people out there saying that it was actually the record label and not the group that had asked for it to be taken down. And I say to those people, like, don't take this from us.
Right, come right. On. Oh, it's definitely the. I mean,
the president got owned by Canadians. Let's just go with that. It's been a tough week.
Right. I saw your coworker Parker Malloy tweet about how, you know, it's probably the record label, and I made the point in a tweet to her that I said, you know, the funny thing is the tweets complaining to Nickelback from conservatives really, really drives home the, I mean, they're on point here, that they are, no matter what it is, blaming the worker over the corporation. I mean, Nickelback are the workers here. They're just making that music for the man, their label, and the label's calling the shots. I guess that's ended on that picture being bullshit, because the guy in the photo is actually, you know, not this Ukrainian like guy. He's actually just Hunter Biden's partner, I believe, in terms of.
Yeah, it's his business partner, Chris Archer, who, you know, was also his longtime friend. So like someone that he knew outside the context of Ukraine.
Very Ukrainian name, Chris Archer.
Yeah.
Matt Gertz of Media Matters, senior fellow at Media Matters. Thank you so much for joining me today. And have I been saying your last name right?
Yep.
Okay, I felt like maybe I wasn't. Thank you so much for joining. Where can people follow you online?
I'm at Matt Gertz at Twitter, and you can find my work at MediaMatters.org.
Again, this was great. Really helped, I think, you know, lay this all out on the table. And I'm sure in like a few months, I'll be reaching out to you again, because everything you just said will now have 20 different curveballs thrown into it.
I'm sure you will. This is not going to go away, even though, again, very simple story. It's a complicated story and a simple one.
Have a good night.
Take care.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my God. What a story, really. And, geez. We'll talk about it more as we go to the patron-only part of the show. And you can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Matt Binder. It's early in the month. This is the first show of October. And every first of the month, Patreon charges all of our subscribers. And what usually happens when they do that is that, unfortunately, a few people need to drop out, you know, due to financial reasons. I totally get that. If you cannot afford to financially support this show, I'll go through the ways you can help that won't cost you a dime. But if you can financially support this show, I would really appreciate, and you like the show, I would really appreciate you becoming a patron. And it would help, especially during the early parts of the month, to make up for the people we lose. Again, patreon.com/Matt Binder. I don't ask for very much. It's a one tier right now. Once we hit those goals, I'll open up more tiers. But you know, let's keep our eye on the prize. $5 a month. You can give less. You can give more. But the suggested donation is $5 a month. And the people who make the show possible, really, I cannot do this show if there aren't, you know, patron subscribers. Because then I can't upgrade. I can't move the show forward. Don't want the show to become stagnant. The people are, and I'm going to do it a little bit differently today. I'm going to name the patron subscribers in the order of how long they've been a patron subscriber. The first person I read does not necessarily mean they're the very first person, but you know, there'll be a number of people in a row who joined all at the same time. It's going by month, so if you all joined in month one, you'll all be named in this batch first. But these are the people who've been with us the longest, to the people who are just joining us here on Doomed Now. I appreciate you all equally. Champagne Kami, Michael J, User Me, Will P, Christine H, Nicole A, Dave K, Andrew H, Jameson Test, Max W, Alan B, Benji, Mr. Danks, Fraz K, Jeff K, Dragon Slayer, Tom M, Bobby M, Colin R, Tom G, TM, Katie S, Nam De Net, Ian Curtis J, Cena, Thaddeus A, Tamni G, Janelle A, Jasmine H, Struggle Session, Abigail T, Zarin, Joseph R, David Z, Greg D, Scott R, Wootopian, Dan M, Dank Uger, Ryan Left is Best, FTW All Day, Adam Q, Romina O, Ari R, Katz, Melissa M, Stephen S, Dan, Lisa D, Sean H, Justin S, Swizzle M, Null Style, John S, Jeremy M, Michael B, Why That Thai Guy, BZ, Michael M, Chi, Tina M, Jonathan B, Ben, What Do You Mean Videos, excuse me, sorry, Brosnan, Grim, David P, Joyce M, Odeth, Jonathan L, Eugene B, Justin M, Kaushal, Lisa H, Dan K, and our newest, just joining in under the wire, subscribers are John G and Zachary P. Thank you guys so much for supporting the show. I really, again, cannot thank you enough. Patreon.com/MattBinder. Now, if you cannot afford to, totally cool, you can support the show by subscribing to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/MattBinder. Or if you want to give a one-off donation, you could do so in the YouTube live stream chat right now by sending over a super chat. You give whatever amount you want via the super chat. And plus, when we go to the members half of the show right now, I will read your comments for sure. They won't be skipped, and they will jump to the head of the line. Again, youtube.com/MattBinder. DoomedPod.com for the podcast version of the show. You can listen to the show right there on the site. You can subscribe to iTunes, Google Play, etc. right there via the links on the page. What else? Follow me on Twitter at MattBinder. Follow me on Instagram, which I don't use that much, but maybe if you start following me in there, I will, at MattBinder. Follow me on Facebook, which I also don't use that much, but again, same thing. Facebook search MattBinder. Excuse me, jeez. I feel like I'm forgetting something. Oh. iTunes reviews. Leave a star review, a written review. We're close to hitting, like, I think 200 reviews. It's really helpful. People see those reviews when they search in the iTunes store. And it actually means something. I can tell you that because I can see bumps when we receive reviews. And yeah. Spread the word about the show, really. Send over your favorite, you know, if you have a favorite YouTuber or podcast, let them know about the show. Request me to come on to their program or, you know, do something with them. I will be happy to do any show, any broadcast, video or audio. If you know a right winger who you want me to talk with, shame them into talking with me. While it hasn't worked on the Majority Report with Sam Cedar in their quest to debate David Rubin and Steven Crowder, I can tell you that for some people it does work. So shame them, and I will be able to have them on this show, or I'll go on their show. All right, folks. We're going to go into the members, patron-only portion of the show. If you're watching live, I will keep the feed up, and you could stick around and watch. Otherwise, you will now be bidding us adieu, unless you join at patreon.com/MattBinder. All right, see you all next time on Doomed! We all know who-